This is KPOO, San Francisco, baby, baby.
Let me touch your love.
Oh, why don't you let me in? Let me be the first to ever touch your mind.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, or if it's the first Monday of the month, understand something. It is Scintillating Science Monday, and I have a scintillating scientist waiting to tell you all about vulnerable ecosystems. I'd like to welcome Sienna Tillman. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
I'm well.
So, Sienna, before we get into what you do, tell me, when did you first get interested in the sciences?
So I grew up in Sacramento, California.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in Monterey now, but about 3 hours away in the Central Valley. And I'm focusing on marine biology now, and anyone who's familiar with Sacramento knows that it's not that close to the ocean. And where I grew up, there's like not a whole lot of nature to expose yourself to. So my first exposures with natural ecosystems and having curiosity about those was through my dad's fish tank at home and TV and movies. So when I was little, I would watch the fish in my dad's fish tank. He had a lot of African cichlids, which are these beautiful, colorful freshwater fish from Africa.
Uh-huh.
And I would sort of think about how they interacted with each other, how things that we did or didn't do could offset the balance in the tank, and sort of what were the mechanisms behind that. That's sort of what got me thinking about how ecosystems work.
Uh-huh.
And even just things as mundane as when I would come home and watch The Little Mermaid on repeat and wonder why she wanted to leave the ocean, and not understanding how she wasn't fascinated by all the creatures there, all the ways there are to be alive. And so that's sort of what got me into being curious about the sciences. And so ever since that's been something that I knew that I had a curiosity about, I just sort of followed paths through education that have taken me there.
Okay, so when you were little and you're fascinated by the fish, did you just pepper your dad with millions of questions, and was he able to answer all your questions?
I absolutely did, and I know he would love for me to tell you all that he answered every single question and knew everything, and he did his very best, and I learned a lot. But no, he couldn't answer all my questions. I think he had some experience keeping tanks, and he was able to tell me about nitrogen levels and certain diseases that the fish could get and things you can do to prevent those things and sort of keep the ecosystem in balance, how the males behave differently than the females, how they show color differently, and all of that was very interesting. But he wasn't able to translate what happens in a tank into what happens in the real world and how that affects people. And so that's something that I wanted to sort of find out on my own and take further with it.
Okay, so then did you go to bookstores and buy lights? Did you have like a lot of under the sea books growing up, or was it something that you covered in the classroom, or did you not come to it till you went into higher learning?
Yeah, I think it would be lovely for me to say that I was always an avid reader and I was picking up books here and there, but really for me, like I said, it was TV and movies that was where I learned a lot about nature. So of course, when you're really little, this started as like animated films, which I'm still really fond of. And a lot of those are set in nature. And as I got older, I sought out kind of more serious scientific lenses. So this could be like nature documentaries. I was obsessed with Animal Planet. And because I just didn't have a lot of nature where I grew up, that was kind of my lens, my portal to being able to sort of access these different worlds. And because I knew I had that desire, when I finally got the chance to apply to colleges, I decided, okay, I'm going to apply to places that are not only in proximity to the kind of nature that I'm interested in, but also have programs that allow me to explore how it works and study those kinds of things.
So where did you end up going to college? Which college met all those requirements for you?
Yeah, so I had a couple considerations, but I ended up choosing the University of California, Santa Cruz, so UC Santa Cruz. If there's any banana slugs out there, anyone familiar with the campus knows that it's really close to the ocean, which is gorgeous, but it's also set in the middle of the redwood forest.
Yes.
So to me, it had all kinds of nature that I couldn't even fathom where I grew up in Sacramento, things that I had grown up.
Sienna? We seem to have lost. We've lost Sienna. So we are going to listen to a little bit of music while we try to get Sienna back. I know that modern technology can be treacherous, as they say. So let us listen to a little bit of Popeye Stroll while we wait for Sienna again, okay? Okay.
We coasting, travel through continents, seas, and oceans. Planes and boats, we gotta go through motions. Exploring the world, cause we may never know it. Australia's the first stop. Surf's up down south, and it's so hot. Right by the Pacific Ocean, the Indian Ocean is where we floating. Right up to the Sea of Japan. Japan. We in a new land, Asia expands. A big continent with China, Japan, North and South Korea, and a lot of islands. Okay. Go west, oh yes, go west. Europe's next on this brave conquest. Yeah. Float the Mediterranean Sea, it connects the three continents. Let's
see. We've got 180 seconds to travel. Take a car, plane, and boat. So many places to be, as far as eyes can see.
now we have Sienna back. So, Sienna, you were saying about being in Santa Cruz and being close to the redwoods and being close to the sea. So, what was that experience like for you when you were finally you go from being someplace that's entirely landlocked to a place that is teeming with everything you could possibly want?
Yeah, I mean, surreal almost. I mean, for one, it was a lot colder than I was ready for.
Uh-huh.
In the valley, we get summers that get up to like 113.
Yikes.
And so Santa Cruz in the summer would get 70, 80. Mm-hmm. In the winter, colder than that, a lot more rain. So like, I just don't think I really had a concept of what weather could be like. And I know that's mild probably for a lot of people listening. But it was also just really surreal, like I said, to just walk around the forest on your way to class and see the sunshine through the leaves, see banana slugs on your way. Occasionally you'd see something really cool like a bobcat or some deer, and that was just like a part of your everyday life. It took me a while to get used to. And also as I transitioned to being on the coastal campus more, being able to see the ocean from wherever you are.
Yes.
And see whales breaching sometimes, see otters. It's just a little bit unreal to think that I knew when I was watching these nature documentaries that this stuff was real and that it existed, but it feels very different when it's right in front of you.
Yes.
And you can reach out and touch some of it and sort of experience it in real time.
So when you went to college, did you immediately sign up for the sciences, or were you what was the journey to get to where you are now?
Yeah, for sure. So because I knew I had a curiosity for nature, I went in with a proposed major of marine biology.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been really interested in just how many different ways there are to be alive. And I think the ocean is one of the best reflections of the diversity that life has to offer.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to explore that. I didn't know if I was going to stick with it. In a lot of ways, I was nervous that I wouldn't be able to. So I'm a first-generation student. I'm a Black student. And in a lot of ways, marine biology is not something that seemed like it was for me.
Mm-hmm.
Or there wasn't a lot of representation of people like me doing this. I hadn't had experience being on boats at all. I didn't go to the ocean all the time. This was just very much me making decisions based off of innate curiosity for something, and I'm so glad that I did. But it wasn't me knowing, oh, I'm going to be good at this, I'm going to love this, it's going to be incredible. It was sort of just taking a swing based on some of the things that I'd seen on TV and thinking, I want to know what that's like. And while I was there, I started in the sciences. You take a lot of general education classes. So you take like physics and bio and chem and certain math classes. But then you're also taking classes in the arts and humanities because there are other requirements to make sure that you're sort of a well-rounded citizen by the time that you graduate.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did end up sticking with the science because I found that the curiosity that I knew I had really kind of aligned with some of the work that was being done at UC Santa Cruz. Mm-hmm. And some of the classes that I was in were really diving into some of the questions that I had that my father couldn't answer for me, or that maybe the nature documentaries don't go into all the way. And so I found myself just sort of chasing that curiosity as much as I could.
That is, I love hearing that, because I know that there are a lot of other people out there who can feel it's a bit daunting to be the first in your family or the first of your particular ethnic group to be in a particular place. And you just went for it and it paid off for you.
So far. I mean, there's still a lot of journey left.
Yeah.
That I'm excited about. But yeah, I don't regret trying at all. And I think it can be really scary and difficult to show up to classes and be the only one every time, or to see people who have been scuba diving for years, who have been surfing for years, who go on bike rides with their families. I mean, I grew up in a family where we didn't go camping because my dad didn't understand why we would play homeless, right? Like, he was the kind of guy that was like, I work three jobs to put a roof over your head. We're not going to pretend we don't have one for a weekend, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that they didn't appreciate nature, but it was just not a priority like it is for other people growing up. And I think when I got to UC Santa Cruz especially, it was really apparent how different my background was from the people I was in class with.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be really isolating and really terrifying. And I think if you don't have that drive or that curiosity or that thing fueling you that says, I want to see, for me, it was just this desire to discover things, to not stay in Sacramento my whole life. I love Sacramento, no mm-hmm. shade to Sacramento, mm-hmm. but there's so much out there and I just had a desire to see it. And I think science was kind of the way that felt feasible for me to realize some of these dreams. But without that kind of fire, that passion that I feel like I have and, mm-hmm. and definitely had back then, I don't think that it would have been something that I could just get through for the sake sure. of doing. It is very difficult to be in those spaces.
Sure, sure, sure. So now you are working towards your PhD. Tell me what you're working, what the PhD is toward.
Yeah, so I'm working in community ecology, which is kind of like studying rather than one species, studying how a group of species work together, how they interact with each other, how they interact with their environment.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically, I'm doing that in some of the kelp forests off the coast of California, but mm-hmm. also in seagrasses and coral reefs in Palau, and using some really fun new genetic technologies to try and see how we can better understand what species are in a given place,
mm-hmm.
how they interact with each other, and how changes in the environment can motivate the way that they move, the way that they feed, the way that they inhabit space, things like that.
So tell me a little bit about, like, what are some of the coral reefs that are out there? And I know that the climate change is having a massive effect on everything, but what other yeah. types of changes affect the coral reefs, and are there changes that affect them in a positive way?
Yeah, so right now my research is based in Palau, which is an island in Micronesia in the Pacific. It's one of the Pacific islands.
Mm-hmm.
And they have several gorgeous coral reefs, and they also have seagrass communities. And so you mentioned sort of climate change and anthropogenic or human-based stressors sort of altering the way that these ecosystems work, right? And
mm-hmm.
so a lot of my research is based in that, specifically thinking about in Palau, there's a lot of decline in seagrass communities. So the area of coverage that seagrasses usually inhabit are declining pretty rapidly, and they've been monitoring this since 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of my research revolves around, okay, why is this happening? But also, what is the impact on communities of fish that rely on these habitats?
Mm-hmm.
And that spills over to coral reefs that you were talking about, because seagrass communities, seagrass habitats, tend to be really great nursery habitat for reef fish. So okay. when reef fish are essentially babies, right, they're larvae, before they settle onto the reef, they often pick habitats like mangroves or seagrasses where they're protected from predators, where they have time to feed and grow and be big enough to compete for space on the reef where all the big, bad adults are, right?
Uh-huh.
So understanding how the decline in seagrass affects the reef community is really important, because replenishing the populations of the reef is a big part of what seagrasses do. And so my research right now is working with collaborators to see, okay, what could be causing this? Is it eutrophication, which basically means runoff of nutrients from agriculture or mm-hmm. farming? Could it be unclean water, so any sewage outlets that are leading to the change in seagrass coverage? Could it be something like climate change, so warming waters,
mm-hmm.
making it to where the conditions aren't conducive to seagrass growth mm-hmm. or survival?
Mm-hmm.
And so sort of going through a different kind of stressor or a bunch of lists of stressors that could be working to inhibit seagrass growth, or in combination, they can be working to inhibit seagrass growth, and looking at how specifically communities of fish is what my interest is.
Okay. So then let me ask you this. Since you're working on an island, Is it possible to get, pure areas so that you can say, well, in this area there's runoff, but over here there's not runoff? Like, how are you able to suss out what is actually causing it in your research?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and there's a lot of different ways you can do that. One of the really cool things about Palau is that if you aren't a Palauan citizen, you're not able to own land there, which is really cool because it has a lot of implications for equity. But beyond that, it makes a cool study system because it's not hugely developed in certain areas.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a big urban center, which is Kolor, their capital. But there are places where the island is uninhabited at all. And then there are places that are kind of in between. So there's this really nice gradient of urbanization, of human density, which allows us to kind of form this natural experiment, right? Where we're saying, okay, in seagrasses that are nearer to this dense human population, are we seeing significant differences based on some of these factors versus in areas of the island where there isn't a huge human population, or maybe it's completely uninhabited, and sort of using the gradient that already exists on this island as an opportunity to sort of do an experiment with controls and treatments without having to sort of dump waste into the water or manipulate the environment in any sort of way.
So what are your findings thus far?
Yeah, so I'm in my second year of my PhD, so a lot of the work so far has been learning methods to use, kind of conceiving of this project, communicating with writers. But what we do know so far is that within and outside of marine protected areas in Palau, there's no difference in seagrass decline. So essentially, these habitats are declining whether they're protected from fishing pressure or not.
Okay.
So we know that it's not due to some direct human impact, such as fishing or trawling or anything like that. It's not sort of a physical impact that is causing this. It might be something that has to do with water quality. It might be something that has to do with temperature, but it's some stressor that protecting from physical interference doesn't really get at. So that's what we know so far. And so the work going forward is going to be to kind of, okay, test for some of those stressors that are less physical and maybe more chemical or have to do with temperature or climate change, right? And see which ones are the driving forces, and also, like I said, what have on the community of fish, because a lot of the people there depend on these fish for nutrients, but it's also just out of the sense that culturally these fish are important. Also, I like to believe that life has innate value, and so as much of it we can preserve as possible, the better.
So that leads me to my next question, which is the citizens of Palau, are they aware that the fish population is declining? I mean, like how much are they concerned by what's going on? Because it's an island, it seems like they would be just a little bit more in touch than, say, you know, we who live on the continent.
For sure. So what's really interesting about this project is the people of Palau, so specifically our collaborators at PICRIC, which is just an acronym for Palau International Coral Reef Center, have been monitoring this decline, and they have asked us to sort of help them figure it out with some of the tools that a place like Stanford has access to that maybe not everyone does.
Sure.
So they are very aware of the decline, and I think also Palau is a nation that historically, before they were colonized, but even now after, have always had this culture of stewardship over their natural environment. I think when you live on an island, like you sort of got at in the question, you have closer proximity to these natural resources, but you also rely on them more because you can't just ship them in from another state like we do, right?
Sure.
So I think there's just a tighter link between the people and the nature there. And so they are very aware of these habitat declines. and they do have concerns about it. And one thing that I think is really important in this kind of science that I do is not to do what we call parachute science, which is sort of dropping into an exotic, beautiful place for the sake of our own curiosity to further our own career, and not really do anything for the community that relies on those ecosystems.
Mm-hmm.
What's really fun about this project for me is that it's not just about me getting this degree or building a career in science. This is very much rooted in the needs and desires of the people in Palau.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sort of just a tool that they're able to use to help them further their understanding of their own ecosystems and make really thoughtful decisions about how they want to proceed. So it's really a fun exchange of knowledge rather than sort of an extractive kind of interaction that I think historically, especially marine biology and sciences rooted in the natural world have kind of taken on.
So tell me, what are some of the, in this collaboration, what are some of the insights that you've been able to get from the actual people of Palau themselves, and what have you been able to help them with?
Yeah, so I think what's great about being able to collaborate with the people in Palau, especially the researchers, is no one is going to know that environment better than they do. I can have all the classes and all the technical skills, and a lot of them do as well. But no matter how educated I am,
mm-hmm.
if I go to Palau and they've been living there their whole life, they're going to have a better knowledge of what's normal and what isn't, or what to expect in those environments. So that's something that's been really helpful, is having their advice on what is baseline,
mm-hmm.
What changes are worrying, what species are important to them, not just for consumption and nutrients, but like economically. So kind of tying in the social aspect of this, those are all things that I wouldn't know. Culturally, what
sure.
matters to them?
Sure, sure, sure.
Those are things I wouldn't know. The same way, if they came to Sacramento, I would probably have a better grip on the whereabouts and the people and what we value
mm-hmm.
than they might. And I think having their insight in that really helps us focus the science on what's really important rather than whatever I'm curious about. I think having curiosity is great, but I really like to have purpose behind what I'm seeing and making sure that it's bigger than just myself and what I think is interesting. But also, I think what I'm able to bring to them is Stanford has a lot of resources, but also I have the time, because I'm doing a PhD,
mm-hmm.
to learn a lot of skills that some of the researchers there don't have time to invest in. So the amount of monitoring they're doing, the amount of observations they're making about their ecosystem, it takes a lot of time and energy,
mm-hmm.
and they just don't have the bandwidth to learn some of these new skills, some of these new protocols. And because I'm in my PhD, that's sort of what it's all about, is learning new skills and finding ways to apply them creatively. So I'm able to bring that to the table, and I think they're really able to bring like a solid knowledge of the environment and just what's important to them.
Oh, that is incredible to me. That I love. That's what I kind of love about scientists, is that willingness to pool resources, both intellectual and physical resources, to just get the job done. So I applaud you for that.
Thank you. And I think at this point, we do just need to get the job done, because we are kind of, we're, not to be bleak, but we don't have a lot of time to figure some of this stuff out. And so I think the more that we can collaborate with each other and pull resources for the benefit of all of us,
mm-hmm.
The better we're going to be. And because Palau has such a hot spot of biodiversity, I think it's really important that we do pull some of our resources there and in places around the world that are similar.
So I know that things are dire, you know, everywhere you look, things are getting a little, you know, the temperatures are heating up and we're getting closer and closer. But is there anything that gives you hope? Anything where you're like, it looks like they're working over here on it and it's kind of working? Is there anything like that you've witnessed?
Yeah, I think especially when you're working in this field, you get to know a lot of people who do really care and who are putting in as much effort and resources as they possibly can to solving these problems. And that definitely gives me hope. I think especially working with people who are so closely related to their environment and, mm-hmm. and do care so much in a way that you don't always see here. I think that gives me hope. But I think even beyond the human aspect of it, one thing that has always fascinated me about nature, like I said, the idea that there's so many ways to be alive, is just that evolution finds a way. And Jurassic Park has been one of my favorite movies since I was little. And mm-hmm. one thing they always say is life finds a way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true. And there are a lot of examples, especially in the marine world, where life is finding a way. Now, that's not to say the consequences won't matter because life will find a way. But it is to say that there is resilience. There are cases of resilience. For instance, there's a lab here on campus that studies the genetics of corals mm-hmm. and how certain corals are more resilient to heat stress than others. And so there is this genetic variation that allows for certain species of corals to live through large-scale bleaching events and to replenish the population.
Oh.
And while there is still work to be done to make sure that we can maintain a lot of this biodiversity, and that's really important,
mm-hmm.
I find it really inspiring when we do find cases where life is able to find a way in spite of us.
That's beautiful. Now, and this is just a question for you directly, which is, in your research, what thing have you learned that really just sort of blew your mind?
Yeah, that's, I'm gonna have to think about that one. I think it's so interesting just because in a PhD program, you're constantly learning.
Mm-hmm.
And so to pick one is a little bit difficult. But what I will say is, I think the most important thing that I've learned so far that we can all kind of take with us to some extent
mm-hmm.
is how connected our human world is to nature and how much we have to consider both at the same time, right? So mm-hmm. I think historically and even now, a lot of people think of humanity as separate from the natural world.
Mm, yeah.
And we think of scientists who work in nature as completely different fields than people who are working in social sciences or humanities or economics. And I think one thing I'm learning is that with the climate crisis and the issues that we're facing now,
mm-hmm.
if we don't kind of take a holistic approach to that, we're going to miss things and people are going to suffer. The life that we want to protect is going to suffer, right? So I think especially because of the background I come from, the idea that if we only consider nature and we don't consider people, a lot of us are going to be left out.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the solutions that we come up with aren't going to apply to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times the people who are negatively affected by these things are disproportionately Black and brown people, right?
Right.
And so I think what's standing out to me is the importance of intertwining, okay, this is the science we're doing, this is the nature we want to preserve, this is the way that climate change is affecting us, with, okay, what does that mean for the human world? If we close off this area as a marine sanctuary, how does that affect the people who rely on it?
Mm-hmm.
And I think initially, as climate change became more and more of like a hot button issue,
mm-hmm.
people's focus was protect nature, protect nature, protect nature, and that's important. But I do think we have to make sure that we don't forget about people in the scope of that. And I think there are ways that that can be done,
mm-hmm.
but we really have to do work that studies these things as a complete system, not as a human world separate from a natural world.
Okay. Now, if you were to recommend some reading for our listening audience, maybe their kids, what would you recommend for them to understand more about what you do?
Yeah, I am less of a reader.
Or a movie. I know, because you...
Like I said.
Because I'm an incredible Mr. Limpet kind of gal, and you're a Little Mermaid kind of gal, so, you know.
Yeah, I'm a Little Mermaid, Jurassic Park kind of gal, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So I think if you're interested in coral reefs specifically, there is a documentary on Netflix that talks about coral bleaching.
Mm-hmm.
It came out a while ago, and let me see if I can remember what it's called, but that one's pretty good. If you haven't seen My Octopus Teacher yet, that one's really good. It just kind of delves into some of the beauty and intelligence that life in the sea could have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you're starting early and you are a child and you're kind of just interested in what this world has to offer or what I do. I think for me, that was really sparked by the initial curiosity of how beautiful life is. And so that documentary about coral is called Chasing Coral. Okay. And that's a really good one to understand sort of the climate effects on mm-hmm. some of these environments mm-hmm. and some of the work that people are doing to mitigate those things. But yeah, I think those are some good places to start if you're really just trying to spark that curiosity or get a better understanding of what we're facing from a marine standpoint when it comes to climate change and the world changing around us.
And if people want to find out or want to monitor the work that you're doing, how would they go about doing that?
Yeah, so my handles on Instagram and Twitter are both Sienna, just my name, so C-E-Y-E-N-N-A, which is spelled a little differently, but I hope that you can all remember that. I will say I'm not as active as I would like to be yet on social media, but that said, if you go to Stanford's website for mm-hmm. Hopkins Marine Station, mm-hmm. My profile and my email are there, so if people have questions or are interested in a career like this, and not sure how to get into it or interested in my work, they can always email me there. And I check my email every day. So any of those avenues will definitely work. And I hope that I hear from some of you out there.
And you are one of the Wonderfest envoys. How did you get involved with them?
Yeah, so I think I have a great relationship with some of the faculty members on campus, mm-hmm. and some of them have had students who have done it before, and so I was nominated through one of those faculty members.
Oh, but
I think
nice.
What was really the connecting point for me and the faculty member that nominated me was that coming from the background I come from, I think it's very clear that science isn't always communicated in a way that's accessible to everyone. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's not communicated in a way where it's stressed how important it is to everyone. And so I kind of would like to, in my career, try to bridge that gap a little bit where we can talk about science in a way that everybody can be included, everyone can be involved, and we can also acknowledge how important it is that we do involve these people because it does affect people differently, like I touched on before. And so giving people the opportunity to participate in these discussions and the information they need to do so with information and power and knowledge and understanding of how they can fight for themselves and others, I think that's something that I'm really passionate about. So scientific communication is something I'm trying to get better at. And I think the Science MOA program has been a great start at practicing some of those skills and just putting myself out there so that hopefully as I get more well-versed and further along in my career, I can do some of that connecting on a larger scale.
Well, on that note, Sienna Tillman, I want to thank you so much, not just for being such a trooper when modern technology was being persnickety, but for all the work and all of the thoughtfulness behind the work that you're doing. I really appreciate that. So thank you so much for being on the show today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been fun.
All right, people of Earth, it's worth trying to save, okay? Yes, yes it is. That's Enya Orinoco Flow. You know why I'm playing Enya Orinoco Flow? Because I believe that starts the show of the next guest that I'm about to talk to. I'd like to welcome the shapely and talented Eric Garcia. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing so well. How are you?
I'm doing great. So tell me, Eric, what's the show you're doing?
Absolutely. I am so excited to tell you about the show. It's called We Build Houses Here. Mm-hmm. And while the name might sound like it's about the housing crisis, it's quite a fantastical, immersive drag dance theater production at Oasis in Soma.
Oh, very nice. So what's the premise of the show?
The basic idea is that if you are an audience member and you go to the nightclub, you are aborting a ship and that ship gets wrecked.
Oh, okay.
And so you get stranded on a deserted island that is the glittery, glamorous Oasis with drag queens, drag kings, sirens, and your journey in the evening is sort of reckoning with the disaster and how we pull together as a community to come out of that and sort of find hope.
Okay, so who wrote that?
The show is, so our company is called Detour Dance, and unlike most plays or theatrical productions, we're a devised theater company.
What does that mean?
So that means that the script and everything about the work is created from the ground up by all of the ensemble.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I love stuff like that.
Yeah. So we do work with a playwright. His name is Brian Thorstenson. So he comes in and he helps shape the text that we're building as a group. Mm-hmm. But everything from the movement to the song to the looks are all built by the group.
So is this a relatively new group, or tell me about it?
Yeah. So Detour has been around since 2009. Kat, Cole, and I are the co-directors, and we've been making work pretty consistently together. But with each production, there's a new sort of orientation of folks, and the ensemble sort of ebbs and flows, pun intended. And this particular group is a new group of performers with the company, and there's about 12 of them. Four of them we're calling the Sirens, local drag kings and queens. And then there's eight castaways that we're calling, which are dance artists, theater artists, musicians, and also drag performers in their own right. So okay. It's quite a lovely group.
Okay. Who are they all? Maybe I know some of them.
Let me give you this gorgeous list.
Okay.
So there's Mud, the Two-Spirit.
Okay.
There's Lisa Frankenstein. There's Cheetah Biscotti, Glamp UT. There's Sriracha, Cerveza, Lesbi Frank, Sally Manella. Who else? Deuce Lee. I'm spacing them.
But
it's a gorgeous lineup of folks.
And how did you all, you talked about how you came together, but how did you assemble this motley crew of people?
Yeah, well, most of us, like I said, we're mostly, I come from dance. That's my background. That's my training. And so a lot of my community comes from that world. And then when the sun goes down, I'm a drag queen. And so I've met this entirely new group of folks that are equally as brilliant performers, just offering a totally different aesthetic and value system. And so the collection of folks for this production is quite a beautiful mix of drag artists that I know in community and through performing in nightclubs and in the dance world and theater world. So it's sort of like a mixture of networking. And then also we held an audition because we were like, hey, this is our first immersive theater show inside of a nightclub. We want to know who's out there.
Uh-huh.
So it was a mix.
Wait, so is it your first immersive show or your first immersive show in a nightclub?
That is a great distinction. We have done immersive theater work before, but
okay.
This is definitely our first one inside of a nightclub.
Okay. How does it differ from doing it in the other places where you've done it?
Yeah. The most recent show we did, which is hilarious to say because it was 2017. Thank you, pandemic. Thank you, life. But 2017, we did a show in the Mission District where the audience met at a church.
Okay.
And then they got sent off in little groups, and they were led throughout the mission on a little tour with a drag queen and a drag king. And then through that, they all met up again at a different location where performance happened. And this is different in that we are activating a two-story nightclub. There's scenes happening throughout the whole thing, and it's a choose-your-own-adventure.
Oh, okay.
So the thing is not on tracks, and you as the audience have agency to go where you want.
Oh, I love stuff like that. So there's going to be stuff on the roof. And
Everywhere.
I love that. So what are some of the challenges of doing it that way as opposed to in a more traditional setting?
Oh, the challenges are endless, and that's sort of what I love about being a choreographer and an artist is that each project sort of presents itself with new challenges, and you sort of, the work is figuring out the puzzle piece. And so with this type of work, basically what's happening is that you have 12 shows in one, because I have 12 performers. And so the challenge is how to create 12 distinct tracks for each of the performers that overlap in a way that an audience member doesn't feel like inundated or overwhelmed, but they feel like leaning into the intrigue, or there's like invitation and layering in a really thoughtful and intentional way.
So then tell me, I want to understand how you craft it and how you deal, since you're trying to make this this immersive and interactive with each other, how do you craft it from the ground up without some overarching idea of what it's going to be?
That's a great question. We have this process that involves many months of workshopping and playing, and it's a lot of trial and error. And all we know from the start of the project is the sort of like North Star. We know that we want to make a show that deals with rebuilding after wreckage.
Okay.
That's sort of like the North Star. That is the central theme that we're trying to get at.
And whose kernel was that?
That was mine.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm the director and I'm the vision keeper and I'm available as the outside eye and shaping the work from the outside.
Okay.
So the people on the inside.
Here's the starting point.
Mm-hmm.
And then?
Yeah, and then the performers and I and all of the design team, we come together and we create what we call idea maps, and we pull out all of these things from that theme.
Mm-hmm.
What are images? What are sounds? What are textures, costumes, characters? You start to like, okay, let's slap three of those random ingredients together. So I'm going to get like, okay, what's a symbol? Anchor. Okay, and then a character is a castaway. And then a question is like, what's the one thing I would bring on a deserted island? So then I have those three ingredients and I try to make a scene out of that. And so all of this show is just like us trying different configurations of ingredients that relate to this theme.
So does that mean that in that process, things get thrown out and you're like, oh, do you ever go down a road and you get kind of maybe like halfway and then you're like, oh, this isn't working. Do you ever have to do that?
100%. I mean, that's part of why the process takes so long. And it's secretly what I love about creative process is that if you say yes to every single idea, the show's probably going to be terrible and 5 hours long.
Right.
So the cutting room floor is full of like precious gems that are just like not fitting in this particular show. Mm-hmm. But there, for example, we just had a rehearsal where we had spent many rehearsals prior to that writing a song, scoring it, learning it as a group. We were like, this is the finale. And we like rehearsed it. We like did a run through of the show, sang the song, and we all just like burst out laughing because we're like, that was not it. Like,
that was
definitely not it. And so we like scrapped it after spending so much time working on it. But it was sort of liberating and actually just really affirming to be like, you know what? We can put that one to the side. It's not that it's a bad song. It's just like not in this world anymore.
Got it.
Yeah.
So I know that on like with the show The Office, they would have these alts and they would call it like a candy bag, which is like places where ideas would go that they could draw upon. So do you have like a candy bag of ideas?
Fully, yeah. I mean, the exciting thing about device theater is that you're creating so much content. You're creating, generating, you're slapping ideas together, and then something might get thrown away.
Mm-hmm.
3 months later, you're building another scene. You're like, wait, I remember that one kernel of an idea that failed in that context, but here it's brilliant. Or like, what's that missing piece? Oh, we've already spent time developing that. It fits in here perfectly. So we definitely, we've never called it a candy bag, but I love it. Consider that stolen.
I stole it from the office ladies who stole it from the office.
Exactly.
So Before we run out of time, let's talk about when is the show happening and what times.
Yeah. So the show, so it's called We Build Houses Here. It's May 4 through 20 at Oasis.
So this is Tech Week.
Yeah, we are. Right after this, I'm going straight to the theater, or I guess to the club. But yeah, it's Thursday, Friday, and Saturdays at 7 o'clock.
Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays, 7 o'clock, and Oasis is on...
It's on 11th and Folsom in San Francisco.
Okay. And then where can people get tickets?
Yeah, easy, detourdance.com.
Okay.
And then from there, all of the signage is pointing towards We Build Houses Here. So detourdance.com is where you can get tickets.
And is Detour Dance where we could see maybe like excerpts from stuff that you've done before?
Absolutely.
So what's your favorite thing that you've done before we go?
Ooh, the most recent thing is one of my most favorite things is where we did this project with 30 drag kings and queens called The Nelken Line. And it's a film on McLaren Park in the Bayview.
Oh.
And it's like a 3-minute film that features this beautiful line of drag performers doing a gesture phrase at sunset. It is mind-blowingly gorgeous.
Well, excellent. Excellent. So can we see a 100%. Clip of that on...
detourdance.com.
Okay.
You got it. Yeah.
Excellent. So once again, for our listening audience, what days, what times for We Build Houses Here?
We Build Houses Here is May 4 through 20, Thursday through Saturday at 7 p.m.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, Eric Garcia, as a choreographer and director, I want to thank you so much, Eric Garcia, choreographer and director, for being on the show today.
I am so grateful to be here. It was so nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah.
People of Earth, this is your opportunity to leave your homes like the rest of the world is doing right now. I was out and about the other day and it was jumping and it was like, oh, we're kind of getting back to normal, even though, you know, still stuff going on, but you can still go outside. If you are worried about getting something, bring a mask, wear your mask. You'll be good if you just cover it up. And if you're not worried, just go out and have a good time. It's almost time for me to ride off into the sunset. But before I go, I want to remind you that KPO is the listener-sponsored radio station. We're able to stay on the air through your very generous tax-deductible donations. So why not send a check or money order to KPOO, Post Office Box 156650, San Francisco, 94115, or you can go to our website, kpoo.com, and click on the donations link, and it's all going to happen there. It's going to be beautiful. Mr. Ford is going to be pleasuring your ear hole in just a bit, so why don't you just stay and listen to a little bit of Staple Singers. Until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodly-doo.
It takes more than I ever did.